From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com. It certainly is. Good morning. Hi, how are you? This is Patrick Timpone, and you've got OneRadioNetwork.com, February 25, 2010. We're live here every morning, and it's an honor to be here live with you, as we are every morning, 10 a.m. Central Time, broadcasting worldwide on the web, OneRadioNetwork.com. Tomorrow, one of our favorite days, Open Phone Friday. We say anything goes, and usually do, or does. And next week, what do we have coming up? Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. We've talked to Dr. Gonzalez before. He does amazing work. He has a new book out on cancer. Dr. David Jubb. We'll be talking to Dr. Jubb from Australia. He's a good one. Andrew Goss, our regular weekly adventure with Andrew. Lee Bracker about food and how foods heal and the vibrational aspects of foods. Interesting guy. And that's what we're going to do next week on OneRadioNetwork.com. This morning, an interesting lady, her name is Lierre Keith, and she's up in Northern California. And she's quite an interesting background where she's, I feel like I'm almost back in the 60s or 70s with Lierre, because we could have used her back in the 60s and 70s. She's really an active lady and is not afraid to call herself a feminist and an activist and not afraid to get in the trenches and tell people what she thinks about stuff. And she's a present member of the National Feminist Anti-Pornography Movement. And but we're going to talk about her book and her work and her interest and passion about the vegetarian myth. Her website, LierreKeith.com. Miss Keith, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. You know, as I said on the opening here, I'm a child of the 60s, and boy, could have you, Lierre Keith, out there with us. Holy cow. I mean, you're an active lady. You've never, have you always been this kind of no fear, go for whatever you believe in kind of your life?
Yeah. Really, since I was 4 or 5 years old, I've been seriously motivated by injustice of any kind.
Been a handful since you were early, huh?
You know, I'm actually, in person, I'm kind of a marshmallow, but yeah. I kind of have that in my inner spine is really made of, you know, trying to write what's wrong with the world. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm sort of a still waters run deep kind of child. I was very quiet, but I cared very much about everything that was going on around me. And I certainly was raised by, you know, parents who were, you know, very politically conscious and taught me to think for myself.
Uh-huh.
So I just sort of took the ball. You might as well be as radical as you can be.
Yeah, yeah. How has that been for you over the years? Some people fizzle out pretty soon, Lierre Keith, on, you know, being politically active because not a lot moves in this culture. What's kept you moving all this time?
Yeah, that's a really good observation, because I'm 45 years old now, and I look back over my life, the people that I knew in my 20s who were just as impassioned as I was, and I'm pretty much the only one left standing. Everybody else gave up and decided just to have nice personal lives, which we all need. And I understand that you have to have something that sustains you emotionally and even spiritually, but they all gave up the fight, and I don't really know why. I mean, things are worse now than they've ever been on our planet. And we need everybody out there doing, on whatever level they feel, you know, called to act. We need people to do that. And yeah, the burnout thing is terrible for people. Something around, you know, the age of 30, people just, that's it, they're done, and they just want a nice life. And I don't really know why I have kept at it. I don't understand what's wrong with everybody else.
Hmm.
Like, once you understand all these things, and once you see how bad it is, and once you're sort of called to justice, I don't really get giving up. I don't know. I don't know what is different about me than these other people, but it's just a true observation that I'm pretty much the only one left of, you know, of my social circle that is still trying to be an activist.
Mm-hmm. Well, the subject of your book is certainly fascinating. There's many vegetarians who have fallen off the wagon or are now a former recovering vegetarians, and I am one of those. From a purely nutritional standpoint, in your book you talk about the moral, the political, and the nutritional ideas of the vegetarian myth. So we're going to kind of dance with those this morning. If you would like to join Lier Keith and your host, Patrick Timpone, with a question or a comment, you're welcome to do that. And here's the phone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Let's start, Lier Keith, with the nutritional aspects. We have certainly been seeing a resurgence of people in the last 4 or 5 years. Of course, in the maybe in the spirit of the Weston Price Foundation and the other one. What's the one that it sprung from? We just interviewed that gentleman. I'm spacing out on the name. The other Weston Price kind of foundation thing. But from a nutritional standpoint, it seems like it is definitely a trend and not a fad that many people are beginning to see that they do better, not all, eating some animal foods.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. And I have to say, I get fan mail every day. I get email from, you know, very recently ex-vegetarians who, you know, against everything they believe, they went ahead and tried eating some meat because their health was just deteriorating. And, you know, a week later they email me and they're just like, thank God that you wrote this book because, you know, you've relieved me from hell. So, you know, there's so many things wrong with, you know, this kind of low-fat, high-carb diet that has been pushed on the American public since the 1970s. And we've really been betrayed by our public health institutions. I mean, that's one thing that, you know, we can say flat out. But, you know, the part of the problem is that the human body is not meant to digest that amount of sugar. And you can call it complex carbohydrate if it makes you feel better, but in the end, it's just sugar. And eating that amount of carbohydrate, you know, equals 2 cups of sugar every single day in your bloodstream. And that's what you essentially eat, especially if you're a vegan. That's all you're eating. And that just creates absolute havoc throughout your body. We were not meant to be able to handle that amount of sugar. So I would say that the first thing that goes wrong for most people is just hypoglycemia, where you're in this constant blood sugar swings, and you know every 2 hours, every hour, you've got to put more food in your mouth because you know you're on the insulin roller coaster. And being relieved from that is just so many people find tremendous relief when they stop eating that much carbohydrate. But you know there are further damage that's done by enforcing that much insulin into your body. And so you're going to end up with not just diabetes, but also a whole range of cardiovascular problems like heart disease and strokes. One of the other problems, of course, is cancer, where we know that cancer eats sugar. I mean, that's its basic food.
And candida, And candida.
Oh, and all the candida things, sure, and the chronic fatigue and the exhaustion. And a lot of this is just, you know, when you're on that insulin surge every day, you know, your body has to respond with a lot of adrenaline and a lot of cortisol, so you're going to end up exhausted. If you're feeling shaky and you're, you know, having these weepy fits and, you know, your mental health is sort of deteriorating, a lot of that is just that insulin up and down the blood sugar swings.
I was in the food business for about 10 years in the late 80s, and I certainly remember when the low-fat thing hit. I think it was early 90s, right? It really came on strong. Boy, there was low-fat everything. Do you have any idea, since you are investigative kind of gal and politically minded, where this came from? What was behind this low-fat craze that hit in the 90s?
Right. Yeah, there. You know, as usual in politics, you follow the money. And right now there are 6 corporations that essentially control the world food supply. And they are a cartel. They are the grain cartel. And it's people like Monsanto and ADM and Cargill and Continental. And what they produce is grain. This is the cheapest food that they can produce, and getting all of our public health institutions to back them up and say this is the food we should be eating, you know, means more profit for them. So switching everybody from a diet that was a more traditionally based diet of, you know, things like eggs and bacon for breakfast. Well, if they can get everybody in America to eat highly processed carbohydrate junk instead, they will make a whole bunch of profit. So, you know, it did them a lot of good to have all of our public health institutions saying that we need to be eating these high-carb diets. It made profit for them. And that, you know, that's, of course, what giant corporations are after.
And who are these? You named them, Monsanto, Cargill.
Monsanto, Cargill, Continental, ADM. They make, you know, they control all of the commodity foods. So it's grain. So it's, you know, corn, soy, wheat, whatever.
Right.
And they essentially are keeping American farmers as serfs. I mean, they can drive the price of these products, of these grain commodities, below the cost of production, which means that farmers will never make a profit. And then because they own, you know, they have so much influence over the government, what happens next is these farm bills where the government steps in and makes up the difference so that the farmers can stay in business.
I see. So
we shouldn't be blaming these farmers for this. I mean, they've got a noose around their necks. The problem is that these, you know, the giant corporations control the food supply.
So I see. So then that's the circle where they can drive down the prices to make it more appealing to people around the world, more, the Monsantos. And then the farmers can't make money at this price. So then they have a lot of influence with politics. And then the politicians give, subsidies so the farmers can at least, pay the bills.
That's essentially what's happening in the United States right now. And it's our talk tax dollars are paying for this.
And the farmers can't get out of it because it's kind of like they're in a, they can't get out of it.
Well, the more they produce, the lower the price gets. So every year they have to produce more to keep their heads above water, but that only drives the price down further.
Now, wait a minute. Say that again. That's interesting. I don't want to just gloss over that. So the more they produce, the lower the price gets because supply and demand.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they what happens then?
Well, so they're, every year they're overproducing more, which just drives the price down further. So there's not any way for each individual farmer to actually make a living. And so they're stuck even further into the system where they have to take out more loans and get better equipment and buy even more fossil fuel fertilizer and try to produce, you know, a little bit more corn next year in hopes that they will someday make a profit.
Wow.
But every year they're further in debt.
It's very interesting.
Then, I know, it's horrible. And then every year the government steps in and just pays the difference so that we have some farmers left. But what it's meant, of course, is that there's this absolute mountain of corn out there that we will never, I mean, there's no possible way people could eat that amount of corn. So, of course, you've got, you know, all these industries that have sprung up, you know, owned again by these giant corporations, figuring out ways to get Americans to eat cheap corn. So, you know, the high fructose corn syrup is now everywhere.
It's huge, isn't it?
It's horrible stuff for us. So they've, you know, destroyed the rural communities that, you know, once upon a time farmers could make a living in this country, but no more. So they've destroyed, you know, rural America. They've destroyed our health by, you know, selling, you know, Coca-Cola to children in elementary schools or whatever, flooding, you know, our insulin stream, you know, our bloodstream also with, you know, absolute poisons for us. And then around the world, they've destroyed other local communities because these products are so cheap, they're able to do what's called agricultural dumping. And it means they go to poor communities and they're able to sell things like rice and corn or even more processed products at a price that's about half what the local farmers can produce it for.
Oh, in other words, they can go into a Central America or places like this and offer corn at X, and then the local guys, they just can't compete with that.
Well, exactly, and that's what's happened in Mexico, it's what's happened across Asia, and it's just meant absolute misery for people in poor countries, because once upon a time, they did have some ability to be self-sufficient for food, but that's over now, and it's because of agricultural dumping.
I visited with a dentist and their assistant who went to Guatemala for 2 weeks with a church-involved group, Lear, and they just went down there to do some dentistry, of course, for free, just to help the kids. And they were amazed that their diet, you know, I asked them about their diet, being in the food, you know, the nutritional kind of, and their diet is great, but their teeth are terrible because the kids drink Pepsis like it's water. And their word for Pepsi is actually water.
Wow.
I mean, that's what they call it. You know, they call it, I mean, that's what the kids drink. It's just, that's what they drink, Pepsis. And the high fructose corn syrup in that, as you know, is just horrendous. It's just horrendous. And then now with the issue of high fructose corn syrup and mercury that we're finding, you know, it's just, it's crazy. So this corn thing is really curious. I saw a DVD, what was it, Food First, or where they feed the animals corn. the cow's corn. And they actually said in that DVD, they showed a laboratory where they actually cut open the cow and saw how the cow could not even digest corn. And they said that if the cow wouldn't be slaughtered, it would die from malnutrition eating corn.
Yeah, they only last about 60 days in a feedlot. It's completely the wrong diet for a cow. Cows are designed to eat grass. That's what they evolved.
That's what they eat, right?
Yeah, that's what they're supposed to eat. And the only reason we feed corn to cows is because starting in 1950, there was this huge glut of corn created by, first of all, the power of those monopolies, like we discussed, but also by the so-called Green Revolution. So the moment that, you know, the scientists figured out how to create fertilizer out of gas and oil, the whole thing took off, because then you could just grow this fantastical amount of corn on, you know, a very small amount of land. But, you know, it's an amount of corn that people could never eat. So with this mountain of corn, where was it going to go? Well, all of a sudden, factory farming makes economic sense. It doesn't make moral sense, certainly. I mean, the animals are just tortured. But that's why we have factory farming. It's because of the, you know, this fossil fuel that created this huge glut of corn. You know, given capitalism, it suddenly made sense, economic sense, because you can produce meat really cheaply. It will make the animals completely sick, but it makes them get really fat and really big really fast, so you can produce it quickly. And that's where the whole horror begins. So, you know, we've sort of got this backwards on the left when we think, you know, you hear the kind of claims that are made by political vegetarians, and these were claims that I believed myself because I certainly didn't know better. But, you know, the idea is, well, you know, that the reason that we are growing all this corn is because we need to feed it to animals. And therefore, if we all refrain from eating meat, there'll be more food for people.
Yes, you hear that a lot,
yeah,
don't you?
It's completely backwards. They're not growing that corn in order to feed it to animals. They ended up having to grow that much corn because of the power of those grain cartels. And then with that mountain of corn, it suddenly makes sense to feed it to animals. Hmm. But that corn is not being grown to feed to animals. It's being grown because these poor farmers don't have a choice. Because of, you know, that the sort of noose that they're in right now.
And I can certainly see where many of the moral vegetarians, as you call them in your book, are coming from. And there are very well-meaning people. I have a lot of friends who see how animals are treated, right?
Right.
In these commercial, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And so you can see why they don't want to eat meat. I mean, and they say, well, I can't participate in that. And they do have a point, don't they?
Yeah, you know, I want to be very clear that, you know, the underlying ethic of the sort of vegetarian worldview, those are ethics that I strongly believe in. I mean, it's the motivating ethic of my life, so compassion and justice and sustainability, and those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need.
Hmm.
So that is not an issue. The real problem is information. And, you know, with all the best intentions of the world, I think most people who become vegetarian don't understand the nature of nature and the nature of agriculture, because eating a vegetarian diet results in way more animal deaths than, you know, eating the kind of diet that I eat now.
Now, wait a minute.
But it's only because we don't understand
where that
comes from.
Eating a vegetarian diet actually encourages more animal deaths?
Yeah, and so this is where it gets, you know, you can't do this in a sound bite, so you got to give me a few minutes.
Oh, you got as much time as you want. No, I think it's fascinating. No, go.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so we have to understand the difference between, you know, the world as it wants to be and the world that agriculture creates. So, you know, this is what agriculture is in a nutshell. You take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. Now, right away, the moment that you do that, you've deprived animals of a place to live. That's a nice way of saying extinction. And this is what's happened around the globe for the last 10,000 years. 99% of the native prairies have been decimated, and 98% of the old-growth forests are gone. That is the end point of agriculture. It's bionic cleansing. You know, you're taking over that land. And it's a war against the natural world. It takes 4,000 tons of TNT per acre in Iowa to keep those cornfields growing, because it's a war. This is not the world that, you know, that nature would like to create.
What do you mean 4,000 tons of TNT per acre?
That's the amount of energy that it takes.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mean you're talking
that corn,
Lierre, just of the fuel and the fertilizer and all that?
Yeah, because Well, first of all, you know, one of the problems, of course, with agriculture is that it destroys the topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
The moment that you clear that land,
mm-hmm.
the moment you put a plow to that land, you've started to degrade it,
mm-hmm.
and the clock is ticking.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a huge amount of drawdown. And we're used to thinking of drawdown in terms of fossil fuel,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of us know about fossil water as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is fossil soil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're drawing down the biological reserves of the planet, and one of the main biological reserves is soil. The planet is essentially out of soil. We were out of soil in 1950. Agriculture was pretty well done at that point, and there should have been a natural correction in human numbers. And what happened instead was the Green Revolution, and instead we started eating oil and gas. But that's because we
wow.
had drawn down all the organic matter that should be in that soil. So this is the difference between what's called a perennial polyculture and an annual monocrop. And perennial polyculture, and that's, you know, two kind of big words that a lot of people aren't familiar with, but we need to become familiar with this phrase, because if there's any hope for our planet, it's the perennial polycultures. So this is nature's template, and it basically is a whole bunch of plants that live a long time, and they work together to make a community, and one of their basic functions, the basic job that they do, is to protect and build topsoil, because all of life on this planet depends on topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains. And that is what the plant people had done for us. It took them millions of years, and they created that thin blanket across, you know, the globe that let life develop. And, you know, their main job is to create more of the same. And then 10,000 years ago, humans started doing agriculture, and in 6 different centers around the globe, and that has basically gone viral. And we have now decimated every single continent in search of more of those foods. So, you know, we want to think of these foods as, you know, somehow nonviolent, because we don't directly see a dead animal, but it has trashed the planet. The beginning and the end of this is agriculture, and that is what we need to face if we have any hope for saving this planet.
So, just the basic idea, that I'm trying to get my head around it and understand it, that when we go in and clear 1,000 acres and then plant corn, or wheat, whatever, oats or rye or soy, then that essentially then just less places for animals to live. All kinds
yes.
of animals, well, deer or elk or
right.
whatever.
Bison or black-footed ferrets or whatever it is that you love, they are under assault by this war that's called agriculture. And, you know, because this is drawdown, because you're actively destroying, you know, every year you have less topsoil. And, you know, let's be clear, one season of plow cropping can destroy 2,000 years of fossil soil. So this is drawdown on a huge level.
Say that again?
One season of plow cropping, one season alone,
mm-hmm.
can destroy 2,000 years worth of topsoil.
It's something that's taken 2,000 years to grow. You're saying that one season of doing the commercial farming way destroys that?
Yeah, it can. Oh. Yeah.
Wow.
And this is why you've got, you know, major dust storms all over China right now. China actually is buying land in Africa to grow food for their people.
Really?
Because they're in such a state of collapse.
With all the land they have over there, they're having to go to Africa.
Yeah, they're having to go to Africa. They're buying up huge chunks of Africa. Nobody in their right mind could think that this would be sustainable, either, you know, politically or economically or, you know, ultimately environmentally.
They used up that much land, Leanne, just to feed what the people they do have.
Yeah.
So,
well, part of the problem with agriculture is that it breaks, you know, there's a very, in hunter-gatherer societies, there are very tight correspondences. You know right away if you have overshot what your land base can support. You're hungry immediately. The problem with agriculture is that it breaks that link. So it lets the human population grow to these extraordinary numbers because we don't realize it's drawdown. It takes way more than a season to see what you've done to your land.
Wow.
And in the meantime, of course, the human population has grown and grown and grown. So, and then, of course, you add the fossil fuel fertilizer into the mix, and, you know, the problem now is 4 times bigger than it was in 1950. So, you know, we need to get a grip on, you know, the full scale of, you know, sort of the corner that we've backed ourselves into as a species. But what I like to say is, you know, we need to be a species that, you know, is building topsoil, because that's what every other species does. You know, in one way or another, we participate in soil communities. And for the last 10,000 years, we've been the destroyers of those communities.
So you're arguing, it's pretty interesting what you just painted there, if I can understand. You're arguing that if you turn the clock back and before you started doing this broad-based agriculture, and you just had the prairies and the lands and the trees and all that, and you had the animals, and you ate some animals and ate some vegetables and baked, and you ate just what was around you, that we would have grown as a species a lot more cleverly and with more sense and balance with what the food was available. And because then we were able to grow massive amounts of corn or soy or wheat or, and something like that and eat bread or eat Wonder Bread, then it's kind of got out of control. The population?
Yes, precisely the problem.
Well, yeah, well, it would make sense because you would only eat as much food as you really had and you'd only have as make so many babies, right? Is yes, wow. Well, we've already, now we've done that, so now what are you going to do? China's going over to Africa, so, I mean, so let me ask you this. Say if people really got this in a perfect world, Lier, and they said, okay, well, we shouldn't be feeding these animals, corn, because this is dumb stuff, and we have to start feeding cows grass, because that's what their really natural food is.
Right.
I mean, we couldn't even do it now because it's all gone.
Well, we have to repair. I mean, and this is where I think the environmental movement has sort of been led astray. You know, we're headed in completely the wrong direction. Telling everybody that, you know, we should be eating these annual monocrops, this is plant-based diet, it's completely in the wrong direction.
You mean wheat and soy and corn?
Yeah.
Right.
What we need to be doing is, you know, redirecting the whole culture toward eating what would truly be a sustainable diet, which is, you know, the food that builds topsoil, the food that repairs those perennial polycultures. So food that comes out of prairies and out of forests, which is what we ate for our first 4 million years on this planet. In some areas, though, this does not even result in less food. In areas with enough rainfall, which is lots of areas around the globe, there's two different, if you take, you know, 1 acre of land, you can raise 2 steer on that land. But there's 2 different ways to do it. And the first way is you simply let them eat the grass. And you have, at the end of the, you know, the end of the year, you've got 2 cows. The other way is you can destroy that land completely, plant it to corn, put the cows in a miserable situation and force feed them the corn. And then at the end of the year, you'll have the same 2 steer. Now, it seems completely insane to me that you would ever, you know, go through that process of destroying the land, destroying the animals, and ultimately destroying human health by doing the corn version, when you can simply just let them eat the grass. And so there's millions of acres that this could be done on. One of the really great things is that it scales up immediately, that when farmers switch to grass-based farming and, you know, start raising pasture-raised meat of whatever sort, and in some areas that would be bison, in some areas that would be cows, depending on the rainfall, but they can immediately make a profit. And these poor farmers that are stuck growing corn will never make a profit. They are serfs to the grain cartels, and they are utterly dependent on handouts from the federal government. But, you know, if we can create enough market demand for these products, it means that they will immediately make a profit. We don't even need the government to get involved to redirect all this to a more sustainable life. We just need to explain to people and then set up those kind of market networks that will help farmers make that switch, and we will have a repaired prairie once again. And, you know, the really amazing thing about our planet is that she can still heal. If we were to take all the agricultural land that's east of the Dakotas and put it back into some kind of prairie with appropriate ruminants, the United States would immediately become a carbon sequestering nation. So, and this is with everybody still driving their SUVs. But, you know, one of the things that happens when plants, you know, build topsoil is they sequester carbon, and vast quantities of it. In, you know, 1 acre, you can sequester up to 1,000 pounds of carbon a year.
It just eats it up.
Yeah, it just uses it. By building the organic matter in the soil, and one of the things that they use is the building block of soil is essentially carbon. So if you let the perennials do that, annuals can't do it. If you let the perennials do that, we actually could stop global warming dead in its tracks. And the numbers on that are, if we did this all over the globe, if we took 75% of the ag land and we were able to put it back into grass, we could, within 10 to 15 years, we would stop global warming. That the parts per million right now are at about 380. Which is a scary number, but if we were able to restore all that grassland, we would the atmospheric carbon would be somewhere at 338, which is well below the 350 that Bill McKibben is aiming for. That's all we'd have to do.
I'm thinking on a small scale, though, if you have like 20 acres or 10 acres, and you want to have a moo cow and have some meat or milk or cheese or whatever. I mean, how do you maintain enough grass to keep feeding that animal? I mean, they'll just tear up the land in a short while and just eat all the grass, won't they? Then what are you going to do?
Well, you have to have this be at sustainable numbers. And that is going to depend entirely on how brittle your landscape is, how much rainfall you have. In a lot of areas, you know, where there's more rainfall, you can keep at least one cow per acre, one cow and calf pair. In other areas, you can keep two. In really dry areas, it might be more like, you know, 20 acres for a cow. And in some areas, it's just too dry and cows are not the appropriate creatures. And, you know, we need to switch back to bison and we need to let there be bison again on the prairie. And so it just sort of depends where you live. So in a drier area, you know, it may not be, it certainly wouldn't be an appropriate area for dairy animals. There's not enough water. But, you know, and that's why dairy cultures tend to be, you know, pretty wet areas. Like, you think of England as a sort of, you know, consummate dairy culture. Well, yeah, look at the amount of rainfall they get. You know, that's true around the globe. In places where there's more rainfall, you can do dairy. In places where it's drier, you probably can't even do cows. You need to really, you know, think more about the drier critters like goats and or, you know, bison. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this needs to be well managed. I mean, we need to understand, you know, how many of these creatures we can keep per acre, but people have already done the math on that. I mean, we're pretty well set on what, you know, if you know your area well, you can find the people who are doing it and find out, you know, how many head they can keep per acre and just follow nature's path, and it's not that hard.
You can figure it out.
They really do, they do the work for you as well. I mean, okay. They just
want to
eat.
Let's take a short break. Lierre Keith is with us. Her website is lierrekeith.com. It's LIERRE. And your participation is welcome. And we have a couple of emails for her already. And we'll take your phone calls as well. 888-663-6386. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Excuse me. We've just taken on another sponsor that we're very, very excited about. Not long ago, we interviewed Dr. Miguel Jose Yacaman on nanoparticles and healing with colloidal silver. Fascinating fellow out of University of San Antonio. So he was telling us how it can be dangerous to have a colloidal silver where the particles are not small enough. And he gave some pretty interesting science to back that up. Well, then we found out from him, the one that he recommended, he doesn't have any association with this company, but it is Sovereign Silver, and they have the smallest average particle size ever seen, which is 0.8 nanometers, which is 0.0008 microns. It's 8 angstroms and confirmed by Miami Medical School, which is a third-party testing facility. 99.99% pure silver. This is the real deal, and where do you see these prices? I mean, really good prices. I mean, it's not expensive at all. Silver hydrosol, dropper bottles, and cool stuff. And we have a commission set up with them, so we make a few bucks and help support One Radio Network, and you get a really nice colloidal silver product, Hydra Silver, Sovereign Silver. It's right on the front page of One Radio Network. And for some of the, it's just really amazing, the prices. I was just, and they sent me a couple of bottles, and I've already started taking it, and I'll tell you more about it tomorrow, some of my experiences already on Open Phone Friday. So that's on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com. Talk to Patrick now. 888-663-6386. Or email Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Having an interesting conversation with Lierre Keith. Her book is called The Vegetarian Myth, and her website is Lierre Keith, L-I-E-R-R-E, Keith, K-E-I-T-H.com. My name is Patrick Timpone. Open Phone Friday tomorrow between 10 and 11:30. Well, yeah, we made quite a big circle here, Lierre, from the high carb, low fat idea that more and more people are saying is not a good idea to the whole, how we've got to this. And I'm just fascinated that I've never really thought about these Monsanto, Cargill's, ADMs, and Continental, and these huge companies. They really do control all the grain around the world.
Yeah, they do. They control upwards of 80% of the food supply on this planet right now.
And then they're behind all the genetically modified stuff too, aren't they?
They sure are. I mean, that's where it ends. When you've got this idea of, you know, humans dominating all of life, I mean, why not go for the genetic code and why not try to make more profit? It's, you know, the obvious trajectory.
Mm-hmm. We've had Jeffrey Smith on and other people about GMO, so we won't go into it too deeply, but obviously this is not good, this stuff, is it?
No, it's pretty horrifying. I mean, on so many levels. I mean, it's certainly not going to be good for human beings to eat substances that they've never eaten before. But to me, the really scary part is what happens when these organisms are let loose on the world, because they can destroy everything. They don't have natural predators. They don't fit. They don't play well with others, and because they didn't evolve.
Well,
they didn't evolve in living communities. You know, where, you know, there's a push pull. There's checks and balances on every living creature. Mm. Well, these are brand new creatures, so they don't have those checks and balances.
Mm. So this is really the polar opposite of what we talk about on One Radio Network. This whole microbiology in our body and the terrain and keeping everything kind of balanced and not letting too many bad guys and the good guys will eat the bad guys. This GMO just kind of wipes that out.
Yes, that's a very good way to put it.
Huh. Wow. And boy, it's on a fast track, is it not? Are we gaining on that at all? What's going on with GMOs now?
I think that the best hope is that around the world, not in the United States, but in other countries, there's, you know, just huge citizen and farmer movements against GMOs, that, especially in Europe. I mean, they're very, very skeptical of this, and people have rejected it sort of wholesale. So in the United States, of course, we're stuck eating it because, having produced it, it's got nowhere else to go. And people in the United States, for whatever reason, seem less likely to question and just to eat what's put in front of them. But, you know, of course, the hope is that we'll be able to stop this as well.
We see a big movement with folks really wanting to try to find grass-fed animals that are really slaughtered humanely and not having to go through slaughterhouses. Because,
sure.
Boy, that's for me. Your host here, I mean, I just look for places that are actually harvesting their animals in the field with a rifle. You know, I think that's the most humane way you can do it. You know, one shot and then you go to heaven and you can move on. Perfect world though, isn't it? I mean, that's not possible everywhere, is it?
I think it's very possible. I think that, I don't think it's that inconceivable that we could get there from here.
Hmm.
But, you know, we need to understand the true problem. We need to understand the nature of the real problem that we're faced, which is, you know, those corporations that control the world food supply, and then further back, the nature of agriculture itself. But if we could, you know, put those correspondences back into the food supply where people had a direct relationship with their food, whether they were growing it themselves or having a relationship with the people who were growing it. So between consumer and farmer, there really shouldn't be any middlemen, or as few as possible, such that you could go to the farm on slaughter day and watch. That there would always be, you know, an open process. If everybody knows that everybody's watching, it will be done well. I mean, that's the kind of places that I want to buy my meat from, you know, just to make sure. I want to be able to go there and see for myself. Is the land in good shape? Are the animals happy? Are they out just having animal lives? That, you know, you can feel the goodness coming out of those places. And can I go there on slaughter day and help? Can I be part of this process? Can I make sure it was done cleanly and well and respectfully? And that is the relationship that we should all have. And if we can just put those correspondences back in, we will have a food supply that, you know, is really worthy of, you know, the word culture.
Now
we've got torture, you know.
We're very blessed around here where I live in central Texas, where there's lots of farmers markets that you can go and get grass-fed meats to really well care for animals. But you know, even here now, we can't even buy raw milk at the farmers market. We have to kind of sneak around. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's
where
just,
I live, it's illegal as well, and we have a whole underground network that I'm part of.
It's out of control, isn't it?
It is. When I lived in Massachusetts, it was better. We had managed to get a lot of it in a lot of counties. It was legal. And I watched, I mean, before my very eyes, I watched these little dairy farms spring to life, and the amount of money they were able to make because people were willing to go to the farms, pay the farmer directly, and instead of getting, you know, 15 cents a gallon having to sell to these giant conglomerates, they were able to get $5 a gallon.
Sure.
Pure profit coming straight from consumers. Mm-hmm. And they suddenly had money for the first time. They were able to pay off their mortgages. They were able to pay down their debt, able to, you know, start saving for their kids' colleges, and everybody had a good life. And you could go at milking time and watch the cows. And I was totally convinced that these cows were having a great life, and you could watch the babies, and you could see that everybody was happy, and they got to stay with their moms, and I had, you know, no moral qualms at all about supporting those farms.
Is it just the commercial dairy conglomerates that push for this not being able to buy these raw milk products in state to state? Is that who's behind it?
Yeah, you know, one of the problems is that in order for, you know, the giant conglomerates to have control of dairy, they can't let it be raw. And the reason is because raw milk does not keep for a long period of time. It doesn't actually go bad, it just turns into something else.
Right.
It turns into curds and whey, you know, from the old nursery rhyme.
Sure.
It ferments, and so you have farmer's cheese and you have whey, you know, at the end of a few weeks, which are perfectly edible and, in fact, in many ways are more nutrient-dense because the bacteria has gotten to work on it for you and pre-digested it. And that's why, you know, traditional dairy cultures eat tons of fermented products. But you can't have that in a food supply if it's going to take a few weeks to get to the consumer. So the moment that, you know, the giant corporations want to take over, they need to break the local food chain, the local food supply, and they need to produce products that will last a long time because they're going to be transported all around and sold to big supermarkets, and it's going to be a few weeks until they're actually presented to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to make everybody accept pasteurized milk, because as long as it's pasteurized, it will stay milk for a month or two. If it's raw milk, it won't keep as milk. It'll turn into curds and whey. So they needed everybody to accept this. Now, it's also true that, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, that some of the dairies had you know, the practices in dairies had gotten pretty disgusting. And you can get sick from milk if, you know, the dairies aren't clean. But instead of cleaning up the industry, what they did instead was they presented this as a public health issue, that we need to pasteurize milk to keep everybody safe. And that was how the sort of, you know, the large conglomerates got control, and that was the sort of the excuse they used to make everybody accept pasteurization. Now, since pasteurization has been accepted, you know, the thing to note is that way more people get sick every year from pasteurized milk than get sick from raw milk.
Yeah. We recently went to a hearing in Austin to, all we wanted to do was, okay, you know, if you guys have control here for now, that we just want to be able to buy raw milk at the farmer's markets and not have to go to the farmer itself. And
right.
Then one person goes and then delivers it to 20 people, and that's what we do now. And they had a presentation by somebody from the Dairy Association with a slideshow. And I tell you what, I mean, if they made you believe that the raw milk was going to kill you. I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the statistics they come up with in slides, and I don't know if they just make this stuff up. It's amazing. And you can see how the panel just, you know, they just nod their head, and of course they just passed, you know.
There's some really great books out about this. The Untold Story of Milk by Ron Schmidt is phenomenal. He's a doctor too, so, you know, you can.
Oh yeah, we've interviewed a doctor. He's up in Pennsylvania.
Well, he's in Connecticut.
Yeah.
This is a fight worth fighting, and this is the kind of thing where people really have to be educated. It takes time. These are, like I said, these are not soundbite issues. You've really got to delve into this for yourself and get all the information that you can to make these decisions about your own health and, you know, the health of your family. But to me, the weight is all on the side of raw milk. I mean, it's done tremendous things for my health, and I've watched it do great things for other people, adults as well as children. And this is food that people have been eating for thousands of years, and it didn't make them sick. So, you know, what are we doing wrong with this? And, you know, who's actually, you know, what are the monetary interests behind this? And then, you know, when you finally make your decision, then it's, okay, so how am I going to get active? So I'm really glad to hear that, you know, people are going to these hearings and the networks, and that's exactly where, you know, the kinds of things that people should be doing on a local level to reclaim our food supply and really to reclaim our planet.
Let's take this call. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Shelley.
Hi, Shelley. Go ahead.
I attended raw milk hearings in the state of Connecticut last March, and as you said, they come up with statements that are so wild, you wonder, where do they get the information from? Well, one of the milk board people, or FDA, USDA, they were all there, made a statement that 90% of all bacterial illnesses connected to dairy the year before were caused by raw milk. And it's like you hear this audible gasp in the room. And one of the legislators said, is that right? Where did you get that information from? And she said, I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
You don't remember? And she said, no, I don't remember. Well, you know, they all have their laptops. They're doing fact check as she speaks. One of the legislators said, well, perhaps you got it from the CDC. They are the ones that collect the data. And she said, probably. And she said, well, according to the CDC, 0.014% of bacterial illnesses were connected to raw dairy, not 90.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Slight difference, wouldn't
really?
You say?
Say that again now, Shelley. Say that again.
The person from, I can't remember now if it was from the Milk Board or the FDA or the USDA, they were all there, right? And I'm thinking, boy, this hearing is costing a lot of money for 14 little dairies in Connecticut.
But that last part right. that you said, what was
she
that line?
She said, last year, 90% of all bacterial illnesses connected to dairy were caused by raw dairy.
Right.
And you heard a gasp in the room, right? And the legislators quickly were fact-checking, and one of them said to her, well, when they asked her where she got the data from, she said, I don't remember. And twice she was asked, and she said she didn't remember either time. That's a pretty big number to throw out when you can't back it up, huh? So one of the legislators said, well, perhaps you got it from the CDC. And she said, probably. And said, well, here, according to the CDC site, 0.014% were connected to raw dairy, not 90.
That is a little difference there.
That's
amazing. Just a little different, wouldn't you say? And the person they had basing these whole hearings on in Connecticut, attempting to shut down all of these little raw milk, these little 14 raw milk farms, was that a child, two and a half, had contacted E. coli 0157. Sure. It's a really popular strain, huh? Yeah. And the child was very sick. Of course, the kid was also in daycare.
Right.
And they named a dairy where they claimed they got the raw milk from. That dairy was shut down. They sent investigators in. They never found any E. coli in the milk. And the big question is, if this child got E. coli from that milk, how come hundreds of other people didn't as well that drank that same milk?
Right.
No one else got sick.
Right.
But they did shut that dairy down.
Shelley, thanks for your call, sweetie. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. You know, it was interesting in our case, Liera and ladies and gentlemen, when we went to this meeting and they had this whole presentation, then what they decided was that they were not going to make a decision if we could or could not buy at the farmers' markets. They were going to leave it up to the legislature. So it's like, oh, man. Now, how did we get to the point that politically that the legislature, you know, is deciding what you and I can eat? That's pretty strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's this huge systemic problem that we have in the United States right now. And I was so glad to hear, you know, what Sally had to say about all of this, especially because she's clearly really involved, and we have got to reclaim our democracy. And, you know, underlying that, we have to reclaim our food. And these things are intimately connected, as people are finding out. But it just does my heart so much good to hear that people are fighting this fight, because we've got to get out there and fight for our food.
Here's an email from Lynn. She says, hi, Liera, what do you say to vegetarian friends who think they are morally superior to you because you are not vegetarian? I have a friend who thinks eating meat is wrong and goes on about slaughter and such. This is despite the fact that we lived in Ireland, where there is no factory farming and cows are grass-fed, etc. Also, despite the fact that I get very sick from being a vegetarian.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a long conversation that you have to have with people, because you have to walk them through these concepts about perennial polycultures and annual monocrops. And once people understand that agriculture is essentially the destruction of the world, it's really hard to have that be your moral high ground. But until they understand that, it does feel as if refraining from eating meat means less death. It's not actually true, because what it means is the destruction of all animal habitat. We've destroyed 98% of the animal habitat on this planet because of agriculture. So it does not actually mean less death. And, you know, the sort of punchline to all this that I use is, you know, nature does not give us a death-free option. We have two choices. We can be, you know, a part of the death that's destroying the entire planet, or we can be part of the death that's the cycle of life, that's participating in those cycles. And those are really the only options that we're going to get in nature. And I choose to be the participatory kind. And that means that I accept that death will always be a part of whatever I eat, but I want that death to be, building topsoil and repairing the prairies and the wetlands and the forests. And I will take my food from inside of those living communities. I don't want to be part of the destruction of those living communities. But getting people to understand that is really hard. And I was a vegan for 20 years. I mean, that's the reason that I wrote the book, is because I had been there. And I really want to reach the people who hold the same values that I hold. And I think that they have been led astray by ignorance. And I'm trying to lay out all of these ideas and the much bigger framework that now motivates the way that I eat, because those are the people that we need in this fight. Those are the people with the real passion to make a better world. But they have been led astray by, the concept of vegetarianism. Mm-hmm. So, for the emailer here, you're up against a lot, because people get very attached to being a vegetarian or being vegan. It becomes your identity. And when something becomes your identity, it's really hard to question it. So it may be a long, slow conversation over a number of years. It may be that, your friend is not going to be able to hear this until his health collapses, because a lot of people aren't willing to question this until it gets that desperate for them, and I'm one of them. I mean, I did permanent damage to my body, and it wasn't until I was, half dead, essentially, that I was really willing to try something different. And it's very ideologically motivated, yeah. So it can be really hard.
And to this day, ladies and gentlemen, Lierre, there are books being written and people who are willing to continue to argue that fat and cholesterol are the problem for heart disease, still to this day. And that has long been debunked. I think it's been 10 years now. And they want to hold on to it. I've had conversations with them, and I've just not seen any science whatsoever. There's people from the Framingham study, the heart, the big one, that have gone back and said, we were wrong.
Framingham especially, because it was so long-term, and it's so clear that, the more cholesterol people had, and, the higher their cholesterol level, the more fat they ate, the longer they lived. They had less cancer. They had less heart disease. And, every drop in cholesterol meant more disease. And that was what they discovered. And somehow Framingham gets held up as supporting the low-fat dogma. And if you actually read it, it's not there. Quite the opposite was discovered.
It's amazing. Just to me. And then, of course, then you get into the statins and lowering cholesterol and what amount of money that is. It's just huge. And we get emails from folks that these docs want to get these cholesterol numbers down to 120, 130. And we believe that's very dangerous.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous.
Let's remember, Lipitor is the number one selling drug in the world.
Is that right?
The number one pharmaceutical. So, talk
about
the
cholesterol
behind it. Yeah, to lower cholesterol. It just kills people. I mean, I've got stories from my own life about, people who were put on those drugs and they didn't listen to me and they went ahead and did it and literally almost died. Yeah, I was right, wasn't I? Sorry you had to find out the hard way.
You also have something in your book that I thought was pretty insightful, because you wrote the book in 2009. It was published in 2009. You probably wrote this earlier, about some of the hazards, and we've been talking about it on our show, of adding all this vitamin D added to foods. This could be a real, it's not good, I don't think, what we're seeing, we're talking.
Yeah, the vitamin D that they're adding is synthetic vitamin D. It doesn't look that much like real vitamin D, but it's like a lot of toxic mimics. Your body will try to use it as such.
Mm-hmm.
So, it can end up with all kinds of problems, especially in growing children. I mean, your best bet is, animals are out on pasture, pigs especially. They create, fantastic amounts of vitamin D in their fat. This is why lard is, a prized food substance around the world. Get some pasture-raised pigs. And every day, especially if you've got kids, your cod liver oil and your butter oil, and you'll be fine.
Here's an email from George. It wants to know, is it true that in Europe there is a lot more, many more minerals in the soil? We've been told, like the wheat and the pasta, are much better for you from Europe.
I can't speak to that directly. I'm not actually sure. It would depend on what the soil looked like originally. My guess is that the soil is in worse shape because they've been doing agriculture a lot longer. And even in colonial America, it was very noted that when, people from, especially from the, well, there were people who went from the original colonies to France to try to drum up support for the American Revolution, And it was widely remarked how much taller they were than the French, that they were at least a head taller. And that was because the soil here was in much better shape because it hadn't been, you know, agricultured for, you know, 10,000 years. It had only been, you know, a generation or two. So the minerals in the soil meant that people, you know, were a lot taller. Mm. They, you know, they just had better bone structure. So my guess is that the soil in Europe is probably in pretty bad shape. Hmm. Even compared to the soil in the United States. But I don't know. It would depend on what they started with, how good the soil was before, you know, it started the destructive process. But I can't really, I don't have enough information to answer that definitively one way or the other.
Here's an email from Aston. He says a great book that deals with this subject in parable form is Ishmael by Daniel Quinn.
Absolutely, yeah.
What is that about?
That's about agriculture as well and civilization and what a destructive process this has been for human culture and also for the planet. So very much aligned with what I'm saying in the vegetarian myth, and I highly recommend his book. Also, Derek Jensen's work is another wonderful author that talks about a lot of this stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, being the political active lady that you are you seeing anything happening in the federal government that gives you any hope that these people are going to get a clue someday? Or are we just heading headlong into a tunnel with no hope? It looks pretty bleak to me, but
on the federal level, I don't see a lot of hope. Yeah. That is not a reason to give up. We've got to struggle on every level. But I think where we're going to see the most progress in quickest amount of time is on the local level with the kinds of work that you're doing in your local area, getting people connected to real food, getting people to understand that grass-fed is our future, getting people to understand the health consequences of eating that high-carb diet, and helping the farmers by, you know, connecting them to consumers so that they can switch to grass-based farming, so that they can produce the foods that are good for people, that can help them make a living immediately. I mean, there's not a single reason not to be doing this now. And we don't even need the government to help us. We just need them to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. If we can create enough, you know, direct farm-to-market, you know, kinds of networks and get people to understand the direction we need to be moving, it will happen. And we can repair, you know, the wildlife habitat. We can stop global warming. We can stop catastrophic flooding. We can stop this dependence on fossil fuel, stop the fertilizer and pesticides. All of this can be done with a really simple kind of campaign, which is just to get people to understand the importance of grass-fed animal products.
Grass-fed animal products.
That's it.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And so what's on your agenda? I saw on your website you guys have some things coming up here. Let's see. Where was it? An event.
Our next big one is in Edmonton, which is in Alberta, Canada.
Yeah.
I do weekend workshops with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay. They're called Deep Green Resistance, and they're about strategy for the environmental movement and how we're really going to save the planet. So we have a great time doing these workshops. People have a lot of fun, even though they're very serious. And we do those all over the country, so you can check in on my website if you want to come to one. We're also writing a book on the same subject that's called Deep Green Resistance that will be out next year.
Is the environmental movement heading in the right direction, or do they need a little guidance?
I think they need more guidance, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, The Vegetarian Myth, and one of the reasons that I'm working on the Deep Green Resistance book. We are certainly the people who have the right passion, but I think we need better information.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lier, thanks so much for hanging out with us on this Thursday morning. We appreciate your work, and your website is called Lier, L-I-E-R-R-E, Keith.com. And the book, it's really quite fascinating stuff. A lot of goodies in there. You just go, oh, really? The Vegetarian Myth is the name of the book. Lier, thanks a lot. We'll keep in touch. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you for all your work.
Oh, it's been an honor. Okay.
All right.
Lier, Keith, Patrick Timpone, and The Vegetarian Myth. I'm going to go have some eggies, if that's okay with you guys, and have a little... We have this great farmer's market about 45 minutes from where I live on Saturday mornings. And we can get grass-fed buffalo, grass-fed beef. And this fellow actually goes out and shoots the buffalo with one shot. Just boom. 90 blinkers, and they fall down, go boom, and go on to bigger and better things. Pretty amazing that people are doing that. And then, you know, then we do our little raw milk club things and have to get a little more creative to do that, but keep working on it. I think you can go to rawmilk.com. Also, realmilk.com. There's all kinds of resources. You just put raw milk, real milk, grass-fed beef into your search engine, and you'd be surprised all the things you'll find if you like to eat more real food. We're going to talk about a lot of fun stuff tomorrow on Open Phone Friday, so it's my favorite day of the week on Friday. And so we'll do it tomorrow at 10 a.m. I love you all very much. It's an honor for me to be here with you every morning, 10 a.m. Central Time, OneRadioNetwork.com. My name is Patrick Timpone. Take care of yourself.
From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.